You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
I know that you were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
You know what's wrong with you?
What?
Nothing.
Hey, would you mind putting that gun away? My wife doesn't care, but I'm a very timid fellow.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it.
I've got a good mind to join a club and beat you over the head with it.
No, don't do that. If you shoot him, you just make him mad.
I can no longer sit back and allow the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Girls, come on. Leave the saving of the world to the men? I don't think so.
$10,000 for me by myself. For that, you get the head, the tail, the whole damn thing.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work. How you ever got to teach a course in anything is totally amazing.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. Many thanks to Brian O'Reilly for the past couple of hours. But now, at just past 12 p.m, it's time for Bums on Seats, the hoedown with the lowdown on the latest film releases playing in and around the Cambridge area. My name is Toby Miller, and joining me on the show this afternoon are Emma Marchand.
Hi there.
Ed Elliott.
Hello.
And Mark Livesic.
G'day, mate.
The programme... That just throws everybody. The programme today offers surely everything that is cinema, with Australian car chases, Iranian vampires, American movie stars, English zombies, Eiffel Tower rocket ships, and iconic French actresses all making an appearance. Summer really kicks into gear as director George Miller makes his long-anticipated return to his Mad Max series with the unstoppable Fury Road. A whole heap of genres bleed together in A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, a stylish tale of the undead on the streets of Iran. A complete change of pace is offered by The Clouds of Sils Maria, the latest drama from quietly masterful French director Olivier Assayas. And we head to the past in order to peek into the future with Tomorrowland, the new film from Iron Giant and Mission Impossible director Brad Bird. Plus, we discover what exactly is Film in Its Double, an event in Cambridge this coming Wednesday, the 27th, which pulls apart and reconfigures the strange 1974 British horror movie The Living Dead of the Manchester Morgue. But before all of that, we're as mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore.
It is by my hand! You arrive! The ashes of this world!
We are not things! We are not things!
Where is she taking them? I want them back! They're my property!
Oh, what a day! What a lovely day!
Want to get through this?
Let's go!
Even in this age where popular cinema culture acts as a nostalgia-driven echo chamber, there was more excitement than cynicism when director George Miller announced his return after 30 years to the Mad Max series. With current action films perhaps over-reliant on CGI and too fearful of taking risks, the crazy, no-holds-barred, post-apocalyptic world of new release Mad Max Fury Road seems the perfect antidote. Fury Road hits the ground running and then barely pauses for breath for the following 2 hours. Mel Gibson is gone. His wasteland loner, Max Rock Atansky, is now played by Tom Hardy. Within minutes, Max is captured by the outback clan of Immortan Joe, a warlord with a well of water and an army of crazed kamikaze warriors. In his ivory tower, he kept prisoner 5 wives to bear him a male heir, but they are freed by his once trusty lieutenant, Imperator Furiosa, played by the striking Charlize Theron. A furious Joe gives chase, leading an arsenal of souped-up muscle cars into the desert in pursuit of Furiosa, with Max unwillingly along for the ride. Mark, it's odd for a post-apocalyptic world to feel like a breath of fresh air, but Mad Max Fury Road certainly doesn't bear much resemblance to what we've come to expect from the squeaky clean world of most summer blockbusters.
And it's so much better for it. I think the first point to pick up on is what you say there about this post-apocalyptic world. I can't remember the last time I saw a film which felt like such a fully realised world in cinema. Admittedly, we're coming to this as the fourth in a sequence, but there's never a huge amount of follow-through or connection between the Mad Max films. It has been 30 years since the last one. But it generally does feel like we're stepping back again into this fantastic world that George Miller has created, and spending 2 hours zooming around it as fast as we possibly can, with bonkers character names, with ridiculous stunts, and with just brio and sheer enjoyment, and I couldn't get enough of it.
Ed, to come to you next. This world building, which seems an odd place to start, but let's start there. It makes it sound like the film is heavy, like the Hobbit films, which I'm not having a go at, but in saying, look at everything we've developed, look at everybody's stories, and keep stopping to stare at it, at what they've created. But this is Fury Road has precious little exposition, precious little stopping and staring. It takes George Miller is taking it for granted the audience can keep up with his pace of storytelling.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, it has that little sort of clip of exposition at the beginning where you're sort of given footage of what might have happened, something to do with an apocalypse, something that's destroyed the crops. But really, it doesn't give you much, and nor does it really need to. And in fact, I think what the scenery really does do, what the world really does do, is it creates an atmosphere where you can completely understand why the characters are the way they are. There was a brilliant article in the Guardian, by, I think it was by Ben Wilkie, about the role of the outback in exploitation films, and how this sort of it takes on a character of its own, this sort of spectre of madness that haunts the characters, and it's very much the same in Mad Max. You've got everything below the horizon is terracotta, everything above the horizon is azure blue. And you get this real sense that you can drive 50 miles in any direction and you'll be in exactly the same place. You know, you'll be seeing exactly the same things, which if you think back to, I don't know, probably the worst comparison you can make, but something like The Matrix 3, Neo on the platform, running out one side and ending up in the same place. It's that sort of very nature of sort of geographical madness in some sense, that it doesn't matter what you do, that you're in the same place. It's that absolute hopelessness that gives the whole thing, the sort of the characters, the complete reason for the complete insanity that they're going through in some sense.
And you're right that there is an edge here, despite it being $150 million to produce and it looks all that money's up on screen. To go back to what you said about exploitation, it doesn't forget its grindhouse roots. In fact, I was quite surprised when the first character starts speaking in Australian accents and there's references to the cars at 8 Paris. It doesn't feel that far removed from a movie like Waking Fright. I found that gave it quite a lot of surprising edge. And you didn't quite know what was going to happen from one moment to the next.
Absolutely. I mean, what I would say is that I think quite rightly a lot of the reviews have sort of talked a lot about the sort of the chaotic nature, the caustic nature, the kinesthetic nature of the film. For me, actually, what makes it really, really work is that right in the centre you have a core of stability and saneness, oddly in the shape of the war rig. It's really the sort of the anchor, the 0-0 of the whole film.
This is the big truck that Charlene's the current character drives.
We spend all our time around it. We know every inch, every little bit of rust, and that means that George Miller can be as crazy with his editing and his pyrotechnics as he likes. We always know what's going on. I mean, that's what separates it from the Transformers films, is that it has a sense of geographical placement that you know where everything is and you know the value of anything that happens because it's all related to a very small set of characters happening in a very small set of, you know, very small place. It's same with the characters, I guess, to some extent. You have the Mad, the Immortan Joes, the grannies on bikes, the flamethrower guitarists, whatever. But right in the centre, you've got Mad Max and Furiosa, who, despite their names, are these sort of sane, relatable characters who don't have much expression, allow us to sort of get ourselves into the drama.
Emma, this was your first Mad Max film,
I
believe. So, I mean, as we've already discussed, you don't have to have a knowledge of the previous three or Mel Gibson's version of this character for to enjoy this, or to it doesn't need that reference.
No, definitely not, for sure. I mean, I don't quite know what I expected. I didn't necessarily expect this, but I think I was pleasantly, actually, you can't really say pleasantly surprised, because this film just doesn't pleasantly surprise me. When I came in after 2 hours feeling pretty pummeled, visually pummeled and hourly pummeled, but in a really invigorating and good way. It almost has that sense of a silent movie in some ways, I think. I mean, he deliberately shoots it at the beginning. The scene at the beginning is so well shot, it's, you know, with the kind of extra frames or whatever, so it goes sort of almost like the old style.
Very, very good point. The very first chase is
incredible. And you are right in there. So straight away you're in there and like you said, it was interesting, actually. I thought, and this is no kind of comparison at all, but just as Ed was saying about how it's all around the war rig, the last film I'd seen that was a little bit like that was Fury. Now, this is so... Fury Road, Fury. This is so much of a better film than Fury, and they managed to make that so... But it is, yeah, like I say, it's interesting. It is all around this kind of this one very, very small area. But what goes on around that, and the visuals and the storms and all the cast... I mean, Charlize Theron, it is kind of Ripley Redux, really, but my God, she does a good job. And Nicholas Holt and Tom Hardy... Yeah, I think it really worked. There have been maybe some people who haven't felt so positive about his casting in this. Maybe, I don't know, but I thought he was perfect.
I think, I'm not sure, I enjoyed him a great deal, and I like the fact that this is a huge film, as we've discussed, but it doesn't, he hasn't been asked to deliver a normal performance. He's interpreted Mad Max as genuinely mad, and yeah. He spends the first half of the film mumbling and the second half of the film not saying anything at all, and some people have a problem with that, but when he talks, his delivery is so odd anyway that it just stands out.
Yeah, the facial expressions, everything. It is, I mean, like you say, it's such an unusual blockbuster in almost every way. It is so different, and it is such a breath of fresh air, like you say, after watching, you know, Batman and Avengers, which all have their place. But there's just, like you said, so much exposition, so much to keep up with, so many characters, so much I should be caring about. This just throws it out there, you get on the ride, and you can't get off.
But it also feels as if this is a film which is... absolutely free of studio meddling. Joss Whedon's gone on record about the various things that he's had to do to try and meet Marvel's needs for the cinematic universe for the Avengers, and you always feel that Christopher Nolan had somebody looking over his shoulder when he was making the Batman films. You cannot possibly imagine that if with studio involvement half of the decisions in this film were ever
extraordinary. There are scenes in this I can't imagine. I mean, we'll discuss Tomorrowland at the end of the show, another film which feels like it's been messed around by the studios perhaps. But there are scenes in this film I can't imagine getting through any focus group. It's treatment of disabled characters, or it's treatment of a baby in the midpoint of the film is extraordinary. Even more extraordinary to that scene is the scene that follows. I can imagine lots of studio executives getting hot, you know, sweats watching this, thinking, how are we going to get this through?
And yes,
George Miller trusts the audience to understand the tone.
A lead character who's got about five mumbles in the entire film and one vague thumbs up, which was just even itself a thrilling moment.
Well, we've discussed the fact that it's basically one long car chase, thrillingly to sort of from A to B and then from B back to A, which is just wonderful. But there's a lot has been written about the subtext here, and it is. I don't think it was deliberately planned as a work of as a feminist blockbuster, as a feminist action film. We've had strong female characters in films before, not very many, nowhere near enough, but that's not unusual. But there's George Miller is saying an awful lot in the details, the fact that this is a male society, and that of the main bad guy, it's entirely male, and they thrive off mother's milk, and it's just full of things you can just keep reading and reading and reading and reading into.
I do wonder how much of that though is also that. Other blockbusters always just seem to be on an agenda, and there just feels no agenda here. It's actually, you know, there's layers to the storytelling, but it never feels like anything that's being forced down your throat. It's just allowed to play out naturally and go off on these bizarre little tangents whenever it feels like it, and you know, have these wonderful little details which make it feel layered and which make it feel rich.
What did you find, Emma? The fact that again, it's not simply the case of having Charlize Theron's character. The five brides are all given characters. Nobody stands around talking about they've obviously been raped at some point.
Yes.
But they don't discuss it. The film allows the audience again to make that connection. There's no scenes where the males have to then feel upset. And everybody's allowed character. They're not allowed a generic character.
That's very true, and also it relies on you, the audience, to kind of fill in that backstory. You know, it doesn't, and as well with, is it Nux, Nicholas Holt's character?
Yes.
You know, and that's very interesting, the war boys, because basically, you know, this is what's going on. These women are being raised to give birth to his, you know, to his army of these weird, you know, genetically affected war boys or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, I think... as feminist as it is, those brides are still very good looking, and they are all. I'm just saying. That's just me.
But then they're supposed. But then they are supposed to stand out when they meet the sort of the tribe of elderly Amazonian warriors later. They remark on that. On the bride's beauty themselves. Oh, they have all their own teeth.
Terribly, terribly impractical clothing they wear, I thought, though, for racing through the desert. All that flowing white garb.
Not nearly as impractical. It sounds silly, but I thought one of the things that George Miller gets on how patriarchal and matriarchal societies work is obviously the clan chasing them, this warlord, is patriarchal. They spent so much time on their costumes and in their society, which is what men do. You know, that's why they have religion. They can build all these things around this. When they get to the women, they are fairly practically set up, I think.
This is true. But I would say as well, though, that although they're not particularly well known, they seem to be either, you know, there's Elvis's granddaughter is in there, for example, Zoe Kravitz is there, Rosie Huntington-Whiteley is obviously known as a very beautiful model, but they do, that there is a presence among those girls. I mean, it's partly in the excellent way that they are shot and directed, I think, but there is a presence there which you often don't get, perhaps, with...
They're not just eye candy.
Because they're very beautiful, but they work so well in this, and they are also mesmerising.
Yeah, and I think the way they're dressed, which is how Tom Hardy first sees them, that is very quickly covered over. They accumulate more clothing. He doesn't dwell on it. The film never dwells on them in that way. It doesn't shift to a male gaze in that sense. Is there, just to wrap up, I have a lot of people, I think, erroneously are talking about the practicality of the special effects or the action over something like Avengers or whatever, which obviously necessitates a lot of CGI. That's a bit erroneous. There's a lot of CGI here and people aren't seeing it. In the end, might get a little bit too CGI heavy. But I thought it was nice to have a real bad guy for a change. After Ultron and other films where you can't grab on to nothing, there's no genuine threat. This is a scary, Warden Joe is a scary character. And the sort of ISIS behaviour of his war boys is also scarily relevant, I felt.
I think his delivery of the line mediocre will spawn 1,000 memes quite happily. I will happily put that in a loop for weeks. And I've completely forgotten your question now because I was so obsessed with thinking about Immortal.
It's nice to have a good bad guy, basically. It wasn't the most awe-inspiring question, I'll admit.
No, it wasn't. and I was just so taken with thinking about the film again, which I desperately want to go and see again. But yeah, it is a film. And I think it, when you talk about the action sequences as well, it doesn't really matter whether they're CGI or whether they're practical effects. It matters that they're exciting.
So it matters that they're coming from characters. You care about the characters involved in them.
Which I think is really important. You do. I mean, I really liked the last Avengers film. I don't think it was... You reviewed it on here four weeks ago, and it wasn't quite as well-praised as I thought it should have been. But what Fury Road has that Avengers doesn't, it has a real sense of weight, a real sense of consequence. And part of that comes down to the bad guy. I think as well, part of it comes down to we really understand the impossibility of the situation that the heroes are going through. Finding some sort of salvation really does seem impossible, which goes alongside with Immortan Joe being quite so scary and imposing, I guess.
And grotesque. I think, you know, there is grotesque in this film, which a lot of people shy away from. Some of the imagery, like you were saying earlier on, there are so many images that you will take away from this that are really at the very edges of where your imagination might take you as to how revolting humans can eventually become, you know, and it's brilliant for that. Absolutely brilliant.
Okay. All right. Well, Mad Max Fury Road opened last week and is roaring across screens at both Cambridge Multiplex cinemas in 2D and 3D. And due to popular demand, it is also on at the Arts Picture House from yesterday. And that is the 2D version. It's, well, I none of us saw the 3D.
No.
I might try to see the 3D because George Miller shot it for 3D, and I've read some people say that it helps the world gel a little bit. So it's post-converted, but it might be worth bearing with. It is a Certificate 15. If her debut feature film is anything to go by, director Anna-Lily Annapour is interested in 1,001 different things. A horror film with a flavour of a spaghetti western, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night, which opens next week at the Arts Picture House, is also a beatnik romance, a social commentary and a musical mixtape. Set in the director's native Iran, though shot for understandable reasons in a laconic Californian town at night, A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night follows the nocturnal wanderings of a mysterious character known simply as The Girl. Played by Shelia Van, the girl wanders her city's suburban streets wordlessly, her traditional Iranian chador clothing helping her fall into the shadows and observe the nightlife of pimps and prostitutes without being observed. And when she is seen, she follows, and it is when she catches up with you that she really shows her teeth.
Swisher, have you got your hoodie?
It's Tuesday.
اگه الان یه دونه طوفان می اومد یه دونه طوفان خیلی شدید از پشت اون کوها چیزی عوض می شد؟
Ed, it's taken an age for A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night to find a release in the UK. America had the film last year and it's sort of been held up in distribution for 10 or so months. Has the wait been worth it?
Absolutely. I've said on social media numerous times before this programme, I think it's the best film I've seen this year. I mean, it's a really fantastic bit of filmmaking. It's been a wait in a long wait as well because Amirpour has made, I think, 8 or 9 short films, one of which was...
11. I think there's 11 short films before this.
I think there was only, yeah. One of which is A Girl That Walks Home. And in a strange sort of way, it does feel a little bit like a very long... very, very good short film in some ways. It has a lot of tropes from short filmmaking in the way that a lot of the scenes are more for the creation of atmosphere than they are for some narrative progression. There's a lot of very sort of strange, interesting shots which normally you wouldn't get in some mainstream cinema, a lot more in sort of short filmmaking. The dialogue, there isn't much of it to begin with, and when there is, it's very, very stilted. Again, more common to short filmmaking than feature filmmaking. And I found that a really, really refreshing change. I thought it had a lot of energy, had a lot to say, but just didn't do it in the conventional plot-driven sort of way that you would get from most sort of vampire films of our time.
It's as Ed just said there, Mark, it's a vampire film. She's a vampire. She never calls herself a vampire. Nobody calls her a vampire, and that mythology doesn't... it just resonates by being there. It's not really mentioned. That's a very dire genre film, but filmmakers keep Jim Jarmusch last year with... what was it? The
Only Lovers Left Alive.
Thank you very much. Only Lovers Left Alive. I sort of found a fresh take on it. I'd Let the Right One In, found a fresh take on it. Does this sit alongside those in finding a fresh way to tell the story of a very, very familiar character?
I think it does. It's funny you mentioned Jim Jarmusch there, because that's the very much the vibe I got from having seen some of Jim Jarmusch's earlier films in the past couple of years. I was relieved to see it wasn't just me thinking that when I saw some of the other online reviews as well. The mood that set straight away at the beginning with the sort of laid-back soundtrack and the sort of black-and-white Western photography that's been set up in this little sort of backwater place. But it then goes off and explores other avenues and you're in no doubt about the sort of the sense of the vampire. There are a few random gory bits as well with we're trying to spoil bits and pieces, but you're left in no doubt about what's going on. But it's an interesting juxtaposition of a lot of these different elements which actually do eventually all come together.
Lily Amirpour find her own voice? As you said, it is very Jarmusch in its black and white scope photography and in the use of the music and certainly the spaghetti western vibe, and it's a little bit like early Alex Cox as well in some respects. Does she find her own voice? Does she manage to filter everything through that, or does it just become a parade of fascinating and impressive ticks from other filmmakers?
No, I think there is her own voice in there. It's interesting for me as well. I've seen a lot of Iranian cinema in the past few years as well. So seeing that contrast between the very traditional character focus of a lot of Iranian cinema and the way it's been approached in this film as well.
Ed, as you said, it was originally a short film, and it's just under 2 hours now. It does. I watched it again last night after seeing it earlier this year, and I felt it was starting to. It loses focus when it does drift away from our hero character and who's not really a hero, but and the girl character and the romance that these two feature. Whenever she goes away from that, it just seems to. The film doesn't quite seem to know what story it's telling.
It does appear as if it loses a little bit of steam after about an hour and 10 minutes. The last sort of half an hour maybe has a little bit of less intensity than the first. For me, that kind of works, and it works, again, going back to sort of the style aspects of the film. A lot of the criticism of the film and a lot of the reviews have given it sort of 4 stars, is that it's more sort of style than substance, which I think is completely wrong. I think what it is it's kind of a feminist revenge fantasy with an emphasis on the word fantasy. It's a strange world in which sort of has, where all of the main characters' dreams are kind of being played out. You have Arash, the lead male character, who's kind of a James Dean, Iranian James Dean, trying to be independent but is held down by his father and his money ties and all that sort of business. On the other side, you've got this sort of Cure-era vampire girl who is sort of fighting against the system, the patriarchy in this case. As you see in the last half hour, yes, it may be less tense, but what you start to see is their fantasies effectively being made flesh. And that fits in with the style because effectively, the way in which it's shot, you've got that sort of blurry edge to the camera lens. Mm. You've got this world of sort of pumping oil drums that are kind of like black rutting animals in the background, these sort of huge...
But though that's imagery from Near Dark. It starts to tread too heavily on
the... What I'm saying is that it's trying to dislocate yourselves from viewing it as reality and instead trying to view it as fantasy. And that's why I think, although it loses pace in the last bit, it's thematically still working for me.
Mark, it's perhaps a strange point to make, but it bugged me slightly and then became strangely fascinating that it wasn't... I didn't expect it to be shot in Iran, because that would be... that's impossible under current circumstances, and this film won't even be shown there except surreptitiously. Mm. But I found, when I found that it was just shot not far from Los Angeles, I thought, well, and then I looked at that location on Google Maps, more for me, because I like to spoil the endings. The film lost some of its power. For me, it became a slightly more fascinating as science fiction, like faking the moon landings, which obviously they didn't do, but reminded me of that. I don't know, it felt like, it gave me a weird sense of the film, the fact that we were looking at a pretend Iran.
It does feel slightly sort of otherworldly, and certainly, you know, from the other Iranian films I've seen recently, particularly Asghar Farhadi, who's you know, had a good run of films in the past couple of years, I can't remember the name of him, the guy who did This Is Not a Film... documentary, and he's a very famous filmmaker, and I've forgotten his name, and that's really embarrassing. Anyway, yeah, there goes my credentials as an expert in Iranian cinema. However, through all of those films, you do get this sense of Iran as being geographically a very traditional kind of Middle Eastern country, and what this does, because it's got this almost Western setting and feeling, it gives you that weird feeling of displacement, and nothing's ever quite right. You're always just slightly on edge because, you know, nothing ever quite sits together quite right in terms of the geography. It feels like its own creation, never quite Iran, never quite this sort of Western milieu it's trying to create. And actually, I quite like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we're saying it doesn't seem like Iran. What we're really saying is it doesn't seem like the Iran that we get from other types of cinema. And it actually, I mean, Amitpour, she's grown up partially in England, partially in America, partially in Iran, that it feels like kind of a sort of young, slightly hipsterish version of what might be
behind closed doors.
And I think also the important thing is, something that I thought was absolute genius is the chador, which you mentioned, yes, in the intro, takes on this sort of almost like, rather than a garment, it's like a hole into the,
well, it's an article sort of clothing of the patriarchal society suddenly turned into turned into a cloak of, as you said, sort of feminist power. I think that's the film basically.
Yeah, I mean, you could say the location maybe doesn't work, but that aspect of sort of Islamic society being transformed is genius in my book.
I agree. And we can end the show now because I've mentioned patriarchy twice. So that bingo game's over.
Disappears.
Okay.
And Jafar, yes, Panahi was the person whose name I was trying to think of and failed to do miserably. So,
thank you. Thank you, Mark. A Girl Walks Home Alone at Night opened yesterday in the UK, May the 22nd, and is showing at the Arts Picture House from next Friday. It was delayed by them suddenly taking on Mad Max. So it's from next Friday, May the 30th, it'll be screening. It is a Certificate 15.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
You are indeed listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. And now for something completely different. This coming Wednesday, so May the 27th, Cambridge's Memorial Unitarian Church will play host to a series of readings and visual performances to celebrate the release of Jolly Lad, an autobiography of John Doran, who, if you don't know, is founder and editor of the Quietus Music website. The evening is entitled An English Trip, and part of it is set aside for a performance of Film and Its Double by Andy Sharp, otherwise known from his music releases and writings as The English Heretic. A mixture of spoken word, interacting with manipulated and processed video. The intention of Film in Its Double is to break down a film into a patchwork of references, some deliberate, some happenstance. And on the night of the 27th, English Heretic will be doing just that, with the obscure British horror The Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue. Shot in 1974 by Spanish director Jorge Grau, The Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue is a very English zombie movie, but it's also a strange and disturbing film which captures Britain in flux. I spoke to English Heretic about the screening this coming Wednesday. I asked about visiting the locations of Living Dead of the Manchester Morgue, a process which was a catalyst to investigate the film further, and how he goes about scraping away the layers to reveal a possible palimpsest of a movie. But I began by asking what he meant when he said he was working towards creating a private inner cinema.
Anyone about? There.
That the private inner cinema is a means of creating a portal through film and film locations, more specifically. Even within a very low budget, it's very difficult for individual artists to make cinema. Out of that difficulty, I think there's a tendency to create your own private cinema. And people are doing that with this whole concept of like imaginary soundtracks. But I wanted to extend the idea through kind of acting out, really, you know, observance of going to places. And I remember being very young and acting out films and television series after they were on as a kid, you know, and I thought you could extend that into an adult arena, and you could act out films and in a sense try and enter the film through various kind of non-linear means. So a lot of this theory sort of comes from two threads, really. The work of J.G. Ballard, who was very interested in a kind of non-linear approach to fiction, and I'm sort of applying that to kind of multimedia, really. And the second comes from occultism, really, but the work of an occultist called Kenneth Grant, who was an acolyte of Aleister Crowley, and his lodge were using fictions in their magical practice. So they were using pulp fiction like Sax Roma books, but also using Dracula and Nosferatu and The Mummy and films like that as kind of portals, really.
The core of the Film and Its Double event in Cambridge, which seems to be the Living Dead of the Manchester Morgue. Judging from what I've read, you didn't think it was the rich experience that it now is until you went looking for the locations. Is that sort of roughly right?
Yeah, I think so, definitely. Yeah, it is a, you know, it's a kind of literalism of location. The Living Dead of the Manchester Morgue is about the third in the series of kind of investigations I've done throughout the English Heretic project. I started off with Witchfinder in general because I'm based up in Suffolk and Ipswich, and there were a lot of correlations and synchronicities between my life and my location, and developed this idea of a kind of sacred geography of British cinema, this idea that there were this is a fascinating sort of overlay of folklore and synchronicities that come from investigating film, its location, and also its position in the milieu of kind of pop culture. And so Living Dead at the Manchester Morgue is the third in the series. It's a kind of cultural map of the place, the film, and the time as well. You know, the 70s when the film was made, I relate to, again, 70s magic and Afrofuturism and things like that. So there was this kind of very interesting way you could use it as a cultural map in lots of ways. And of course, like Derbyshire, where it's filmed, was the centre really of the miners' strike, and it was what caused the rift in the miners' strike. See, the Derbyshire miners, they're the ones who capitulated. So there's all this kind of rich overlay, and I relate the film to a local murder by miners at the exact spot that they filmed one of the key scenes. So you kind of see this unconscious, I'm sure they weren't conscious of this folklore, but I love the way it seems to have, you have this concept in history of a palimpsest of layers of meaning. And I love the way that film unwittingly picks up on that through kind of like its intense use of an editing of landscape and things like that.
Sergeant, this is Craig reporting at the cemetery. They're dead people trying to kill me.
How how does that come across on the evening itself? In the publicity, you mention immersive. So how does this unravel? How does this unwrap for the audience?
So what I've been doing is processing a lot of the footage from it together with home footage, and also cutting it with different landscapes. There's a particular scene with the lead actress, and she's got out of a mini and she's wandering by this place, this beauty spot in Dovedale, which we visited, and she looks around and the zombie appears from a fence. So I'm very interested in that scene because, having visited there and it being a very real place, you've suddenly got this kind of unreal happening there. So I'm very interested in these kind of specific scenes that you can then cut up to something different. So there'll be slow motion processed versions of these scenes, colorized, and then it'll switch to another narrative. So I'm really using cut up, but I'm also interested in the visual dialogue. So that's how the imagery will work. And then on top of that, there'll be readings. And so kind of 3D way of getting into the film. And that's what I'll be delivering. So hopefully it'll be something that will garner interest in the film, but it'll also garner interest in the interpretation of the film. And so people might come to the film from a completely different angle after listening to it.
So there's sort of a John Cage thing going on here, that you're not showing the whole film and adding to it. You're looping and, as you said, processing certain parts of it to add a different context which highlights the original in a new light.
Yes, but also to be part of it as well. So these people, you know, am I this actor? Who am I in this film? Am I the hero? It's a way of, in magical concepts, there's this idea of the assumption of the god form, where you can invoke yourself into a god form. So, like, rather than, you know, Horus or Odin, it's the hippie Hell's Angel figure in George, or whatever his name is, in so we become these characters, you know. So that's the kind of process, really. So these characters come part of us. And there's a very interesting J.J. Ballard story called Motel Architecture, where the person lives in this solarium and he just watches edits of Psycho on lots of different screens and somehow enters the film. And I think that's a very good analogy, is that we can take these kind of like very iconic moments in film, or even not necessarily iconic at the moment, but you can make them iconic. So that's what I'm interested in.
It's the work that you're doing, and this sort of intertextual reading of a film, it's new to me. At least this sort of slightly occult direction is new to me. Is it a fairly active area of research? Because it seems to link a little bit to, in musical terms, the ontology and the work that broadcast and people like that have been doing.
Yeah, I mean, I pretty much started at the same time as Ghostbox, but I slightly come from a different angle. Mine comes a lot from magical theory and magical practice. I was interested in Burroughs and how that influenced industrial culture. And they're incredibly interested in the editing technique, how you can edit reality, how you can move images around on film, and then you can then reconstruct reality. So that's where really I'm coming from. It's partly an investigation. And as I said, there's very strange happenings I've had from doing music and investigating in this intense way. Certainly stuff I did at the locations for Blood on Satan's Claw, huge amount of weird synchronicities came out after it. I've got this central conceit that, you know, I love the kind of ritual scenes in 70s horror, you know, think of like Blood on Satan's Claw and Wicker Man and things like that, these massively ornate rituals. My argument is that the gods would far much prefer this than someone in their kind of like bedsit doing it, because they want ornateness and things like that. They want a scene like you know, the invocation of Goat of Mendes in Devil Rides Out. And so I'm sort of, you know, playing on that, but having played on that, I realize that you do enter this reality where things manifest in a strange way. And I just think it's, you just open yourself up, you know, reality opens up, and significance and connections.
Out of interest, do you see an evening like this as a form of lecture, or as a new development and storytelling.
There's elements of both. So yeah, it's a happening as well. I think, you know, I'm very conscious, you know, like kind of these kind of experimental sort of happenings in the 60s and 70s and love them. But we got newer technology now, you know, we can do things with video that we couldn't do 30, 40 years ago. So we've got all this new technology that is just sort of begging to have these kind of immersive happenings, if you like. I call it a brutal happening, you know. A happening was a good thing in the 60s, but it's a kind of brutal happening because there's a lot of talk about dystopian England, really. So yeah, it's a brutal happening.
You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105.
Many thanks to Andy Sharp for the interview and to Evie Salmon from Corpus Christi for bringing the screening and the event to my attention. It's certainly out of left field, but I'm all for anything that brings a fresh perspective to cinema. As mentioned, the An English Trip event is this Wednesday, 27th of May at 7:30 at Cambridge's Memorial Unitarian Church. It costs only £3 in advance or £4 on the door, and you can find out much, much more by visiting either its Facebook page, the events page, just simply type in An English Trip, or by visiting English Heretic's website, which is www.englishheretic.blogspot.com. You're listening to Bums on Seats on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city. My name is Toby Miller, and with me in the studio today are Emma Marchant, Mark Livesich, and Ed Elliott.
If you like books, writing, fiction, non-fiction, poetry, drama, and chat with authors from Cambridge and beyond, then save the page to bookmark every other Saturday at 1 p.m. with me, Lee Chambers, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city.
Yes, following on after we're done and dusted for the day will be Bookmark, which this afternoon is talking to Eleanor Stewart, a former nun who has written her memoirs, plus interviews with Michael Rosen and Maria Young about their joint work, which is called What is Humanism? Then at 2 p.m, it's the second of this year's Summer Saturdays, as Cambridge 105 broadcasts from many of the city's summer events. Today, Tim Willett and Julian Clover are reporting from Eat Cambridge, while Stom Smith is reporting from the 42nd Cambridge Beer Festival. At 5 p.m, it's Radio Dante for all the Italians in Cambridge or for those interested in Italian culture. Then at 6 p.m, it's the music and chat of Jason Allen. Then from 7 until midnight, it's Cambridge 105's take on the Eurovision Song Contest. So a wide variety of radio still to come today on Cambridge 105. There's still another, as usual, 20 minutes of Bums on Seats left. We will wrap up with Tomorrowland, but before that, we're heading back to the stage.
I played Sigrid when I was 18.
And because you were Sigrid, only you can be Helena now.
So who's going to play Sigrid?
Joanne Ellis.
I will play the one who drives her to suicide.
She's probably my favorite actress.
You mean more than me.
She's totally fascinating. Despite her superpowers.
Oh my God, I hate you sometimes so much.
The play tells a simple story. An older woman falls in love with a scheming girl that has her wrapped around her little finger. The girl takes advantage of her, squeezes everything she can out of her, then dumps her.
It's called the real world. Welcome.
Time. Youth. She has her life ahead of her.
I'm in the middle of a divorce. I feel alone and vulnerable.
What's wrong with my acting?
Nothing.
Over the last decade or so, French director Olivier Assayas has been building one of the most versatile resumes in cinema, mixing the thrills of Irma Vep and his five-hour biopic on Carlos with the dreamlike drama of Clean and the revolutionary-minded Apremier. His latest film, The Clouds of Sils Maria, works along similar lines to his 2008 masterpiece Summer Hours, with a slow-burning story that is aware of how time passes and how its passing affects the world around it. Juliette Binoche stars as Maria Enders, a popular classical actress turning her back on Hollywood and heading back to the stage. Against her better judgment, she's been convinced to return to the play Maloja Snake, in which she made her name as a young actor, playing a young office worker who seduces her boss. Now she's set to play the broken-hearted older woman, and Maria is struggling with the role and looks to her assistant, played by Kristen Stewart, for help. Mark, Olivier Assayas's films can be a hard sell even for the art house audience. His pace is, at first glance at least, meandering, and he doesn't really punctuate his films with bursts of eye-catching drama or histrionics, really. All of this I like a great deal, but how did you find The Clouds of Sils Maria?
I liked it a lot as well. I think actually one of the things that struck me is you do actually find yourself trying to think what's happening between some of the pauses. He's makes great use in this film of the fade to black. There's probably a technical term for that.
No, it's fade to black.
Yes. anyway, whatever that's called. In particular in those moments, it sort of comes at the end of a scene and then you're left to just dwell on what might be happening beyond that scene, and I think that's to do with a lot of the ambiguity that SAS brings into the particularly the central relationship between Kristen Stewart's character and Juliette Binoche. And it did remind me to a certain extent of Juliette Binoche's film from a few years ago, Certified Copy, which is another film which deals with sort of meta ideas of reality and you know, getting into a story and what's real and what's not. And here again as well, you're hearing aspects of this play from 20 years ago, and then it just little bits start to intrude, and then they're starting to do line readings from the play, and SAS does a wonderful job of creating this ambiguity of you never quite knowing whether they're actually acting out or actually whether that's their real life relationship starting to sort of intrude on the screen, and it's helped by the fantastic performances from Juliette Binoche and from Kristen Stewart, who are both brilliant.
It's about four realities, really. It's quite difficult to I don't know how he scripted this, but we've got the sort of our reality, the film reality, the play's reality, and a reality that's created by gossip, which comes into play when this younger actress is brought in, this Hollywood starlet who's basically playing the sort of temperamental Kristen Stewart role. If you know, it's a sort of reference to that. Does he keep this all balanced? Does it all not come together? I don't expect it to do that, but is there enough of a line between all of them that builds up a resonance?
I think there is, and I think it works both ways. I think there are times when actually you quite like having the ambiguity of not quite knowing where you are, but at certain times actually it is laid out very clearly where you are in terms of that level of reality. And consequently, because there's these different levels, it has a lot to say, you know, with the clips of Chloe Moretz, who's playing the new younger girl in the play that's going to be appearing, getting into that and exploring some of this sensationalist tabloid headlines that can come about. So, you know, SAS is not afraid to get into some of these little avenues and poke and explore at them, and consequently the effects they have on age. Oddly, it reminded me of Clarks 2, the last film I can think of that did such a strangely good job of exploring these issues of age and the passing of time and the way in which we sort of looked back almost with a nostalgia of our younger selves but know that we can't recapture that. You know, and it's a little classier than Clarks 2, I think we'll be absolutely honest about that. But, you know, it is very effective in terms of taking the two disparate points of the character in her 20s and the character in her 40s and exploring the differences between the two and the pull and the way in which we look back in our own lives at you know, missed opportunities in times past.
It's also, and we have a program here that's filled accidentally because of the way the films fall, but with strong female roles, and this is, I think, the strongest out of all the four.
I thought you were going to say with old people.
No, I wouldn't say that. But this is very much, again, a work of feminism, in that it features three women whose identities are shaped by how the men around them perceive them, and even when they're looking for what they were being told at the beginning of the film is a truth, as in this play, which is written by a male playwright who's since has since died. Mm. Even there, the truths they're arguing over, Juliette Binoche and Kristen Stewart, are truths that have been generated by a male author and how he perceives the female, and they seem reluctant to. Juliette Binoche's character is reluctant to take on the views of the playwright made when he was older and more mature and wiser. I find it a fascinating. I got slightly annoyed at everybody talking about the feminism in Fury Road, which exists and exists very interestingly, when this is a far more layered and complex work. And they're not in battle, these two films. They're both set out to do separate things. But this is a far more complex and mature work about how the male gaze works, in a way.
It is. I think, yeah, as to your original point, yeah, there are no histrionics here. There's no grandstanding. I wouldn't say it's navel-gazing either, but it is a very restrained, quiet film in many ways, and I think you have to be prepared for that if you're coming into it. But it's rich in detail. Huge amounts going on, and huge amounts to take from it.
Okay, well, The Clouds of Sils Maria is very well worth seeing. I think it's going to be one of my films of the year. The Clouds of Sils Maria opened last week and is still enjoying a few screenings at the Arts Picture House. It is also available for home viewing through the Curson On Demand website, which is www.cursoncinemas.com. And then you sign on, pay a little bit of money, and it's good for multiple viewings. It's a cheap way of seeing films. It is a certificate 15. We began the show with the desperate future Earth of Fury Road, and we'll wrap up with a slightly more hopeful possible premonition of Tomorrowland, the latest film from director Brad Bird. Written by both Bird and screenwriter Damon Lindelof, the adventure of Tomorrowland assembles itself out of numerous flashbacks. In 1964, a boy inventor visits the World Fair, hopeful that his rocket pack, which almost nearly works, will win him $50. His invention and imagination catches the eye of Athena, a preppy girl with a secret, who presents him with a badge for a location known as Tomorrowland. We then move forward in time to present-day America, where a scientifically minded teenager, Casey Newton, played by Britt Robertson, vandalizes the machines that are dismantling the launch pads at Cape Canaveral. After she is arrested, she also finds herself in possession of a shiny and magical badge for the mysterious Tomorrowland.
When I touch this pen, I saw this place, and then it was gone.
What do you want?
I want you to take me to the place I saw when I touched this.
Where'd you get that?
I know that you were there.
Who are you, kid?
They followed you here?
Who?
John Francis Walker! You are now harboring a fugitive element. Release her to our custody. You have 1 minute to comply.
Get in!
How is this a good idea?
You ain't seen nothing yet. You wanted to see Tomorrowland. Here it comes.
Emma, Disney Studios' release schedule over the next decade is on Marvel, Star Wars, and updates of classic cartoons. An original product, I know this is sort of slightly based on a theme park, but an original product is a rare thing. Are you glad? Has it worked? Can they still make original products?
They can. I don't think it entirely works. I was excited about this because I really... The Iron Giant is one of my favourite films of the last 20 years, animated or live action. I love The Iron Giant. I think Ratatouille is amazing. The Incredibles is great. And I thought that Mission Impossible was a brilliantly directed action film. So I had really high hopes going into this, which I wouldn't say were entirely met, but they weren't entirely lost either. It is a bit of a hodgepodge. It is quite a confused film, and it's quite an odd film. It's not like a kind of straightforward family film. There is an awful lot going on in this. I mean, I knew very little before I went in because I think deliberately the trailers have been quite ambiguous, and there hasn't been a massive kind of the marketing for this has also not been sort of, you know, it hasn't given you a lot before you go in there. So it's long. It's I think it's just over 2 hours, so it's quite a long family film. There is surprising violence in it. There is, even in your description, like you say, there's flashing backwards and forwards from the future to the present, or what is some kind of the present to the past. There's robots that look a little bit like, you know, robots you've seen before. Visually, there are some bits that are really effective. George Clooney, I think, does a fine job as the kind of, you know, the grown-up, slightly grumpy...
He's the boy from 1964, all grown up and now disenchanted. Yeah. And
I think he does a very good job. Hugh Laurie, I found really odd casting. Hugh Laurie is in this as well, and I found that slightly jarring. I mean, it leads to, although I always want to say leading to that, there's a fight scene. Yeah, it's not really a spoiler, but there's just a fight scene with a portal and Hugh Laurie and George Clooney, which is something I never thought I'd kind of see. This is what I mean. This film is just full of odd stuff, and it comes close to working, but it needed maybe someone to come in and just cut a bit, like it is a bit all over the place.
It felt like, that's the like strange thing, it felt like Brad Bird. It feels like, when it's really good, it feels like a Brad Bird film, as you said.
There's a lot of the Incredibles imagery, you know, because like, when it starts off in 1964, a lot of that super stylized 1964 is very reminiscent of the Incredibles. And like I said, there are other bits that felt to me slightly reminiscent of the Iron Giant and that kind of thing. But when it doesn't work, it
surprised me, because I think Ratatouille is one of the best scripts in American cinema for the past decade and a half. It's an amazing juggling act of impossible things, and it shouldn't work at all, Ratatouille. This feels like somebody should have hired Brad Bird to come and make sense of it. It's a mess of a film. I think the best I can say for it is it's sincere. And it fails, but it fails trying to do interesting things, I think, at least. Convince me otherwise.
Yeah, I'm going to convince you otherwise, not in the sense of it didn't fail, in the sense that it's not interesting. I sat there feeling immeasurably bored. I mean, I think you're right. It is kind of crazy and all over the place, but in a way, it's so surprising then that I feel like the narrative pacing is all wrong. The end comes far too quickly and then doesn't make any sense. The sort of hopeful imagery, it's all meant to be about positive thinking. You know, it's very easy to do that if you're Disney, firstly off. And also, if you're going to present an idealized version of the future, you've got to be pretty darn sure that it's going to be a really sort of politically correct good one. And I felt that actually there was, behind all of the positive thinking, there was a lot of quite sad, depressing views there. I mean, effectively, Tomorrowland is a place where a load of elite people are left to decide the future for everyone else, and it's not democratic.
Yes, but they're elite through their imagination and invention. They're not born into elite, and I don't think they... I think the problem they come... The problem we get from Hugh Laurie's bad guy is they come to see themselves as elite, which is obviously a very familiar science fiction trope. I don't think they set themselves apart deliberately because they think they're better. I think the idea is to bring everybody to them rather than to leave everybody behind.
But I still think there's a point of these people making decisions for everyone else, and there's a complete lack of...
But they're not making decisions for anybody else.
Kill themselves if left to their own devices and given sort of bad...
But that's the actions of one character. I don't think that the rest... we're never given a true view of what Tomorrowland is. The version we're given is an advert.
Okay. So I've kind of sidetracked myself a little bit here, but I think that...
I've helped.
Exactly. But, I mean, even us having an argument about this, I think is kind of to do this... to do this film a merit, because for me it was just standard writing, standard dialed in performances, and a film that felt horribly dated.
Can't see that. It makes a lot of mistakes, but they're not standard mistakes. It loses. It has a scientific. Intelligent, wonderfully capable female.
Female
character
gets tricked by the pin thing of like, oh, I'm in the different universe about five times. The number of times, Toby, I've heard you say, oh, they're meant to be really clever scientists, but now they're tripping over chairs.
That's
She is exactly the same. She is exactly the same as are all the characters. They make stupid mistakes all the time. Why are the robots got grins on their faces and utterly unhuman when they're able to construct these incredible devices? None of it makes sense. None of this future world makes sense. And that wouldn't matter if it wasn't for the fact that it's just really dull. It's just really boring. I wouldn't care if it was had me involved, but it's just not funny enough. It's not interesting enough. The vision of the future is terrible, and it feels like a blockbuster from 1990s when we were meant to be amazed by just the idea of Tomorrowland and it being put up on screen. We've moved past that. We've moved past the point where you can just show dinosaurs or just show things and put an orchestral score behind it and us be amazed and go to films in droves. We're past that point in cinema, I think.
I don't think we'll ever be past the point of dinosaurs and music, but I disagree with Ed that it's not trying to do something interesting, but it doesn't in the end say anything particularly interesting. But it does seem in line with things that Brad Bird has said before. The idea of acknowledging excellence fits in with The Incredibles, with the idea, with Mr. Incredible says everybody's trying to reward mediocrity. I think he's got enough of a twist on that in this, but he doesn't. It seems confused.
It does, and I have to put some of the blame of that at the feet of Damon Lindelof, who seems to have a track record of being in confusing things which never ultimately made sense.
He's the co-script writer, and he was involved with Lost and Prometheus,
Star Trek Into Darkness, which is still one of my pet hates of the way they ruined the Star Trek franchise with that, with their confusing nonsense. And again, it feels like there's about 10 pages of script been taken out at random intervals, which if they'd been left in, would have left a coherent narrative.
Do you think it's studio, because Walter Merck is one of the greatest editors of the last 20, 30 years, is down as the editor, but if you do a little bit of research on the net, there's a suggestion he was fired from the project. The film, it's not that unusual, not him being fired, but you don't have to read something sinister into that. But the film starts with a flashback which reveals that our heroes are going to end up all right. It never seems to know. It's like they suddenly were frightened that George Clooney wasn't in the film enough, and our heroine drops out halfway through.
It
She's
is
still
a family
there,
film, though, Toby. So you do want, if you're taking your family to go and see this, and we've already discussed it. It is a 12A, and there is some, you know, quite serious violence in this. But well, yeah, there is.
There is cartoon violence, but it's shocking.
If
in
you're
this,
taking
this
your 10-year-olds or whatever, then yeah, I didn't mind that it starts off telling you they're going to be okay. That's right. And there are some brilliant set pieces. I did think that whole fight scene in George Clooney's house. There are some really, which looked a bit like Hawkeye's house from the Avengers, and also a bit like the house in Looper. It's like there's one house and they just keep putting into all these films. But I did, and that set piece at the Eiffel Tower, while it is just kind of bonkers, that interested me. I can't say that I sat there. I have sat there bored through films, and this didn't. I didn't find it as dull as Ed suggested. I thought it was.
I didn't find it as dull as any.
I mean,
of the
I'm not the
films.
Target audience, so you know maybe I've got a slightly sort of warped perspective. But I mean, I think the target again going back to the thing I feel this data is the target audience is meant to be kind of about sort of 10 to 16 and their parents, where I think that. That audience kind of just doesn't, maybe I'm wrong, but I feel like that audience doesn't exist anymore. You've got the sort of 13 and younger who go to see, ironically, Pixar and films like that, and then 13 and older who go to see Marvel. The middle ground doesn't exist. Which
and they're
is
not
this,
going to be needed.
This is going to be a
they're
massive,
not going to need these exposition dumps on global warming. Whilst it's fantastic that a major blockbuster is mentioning these things at a time when a possible presidential candidate is saying it's arrogant to question, to bring up climate change, it's wonderful that a Disney blockbuster has these things. But this is taught in schools. I think the children's the wrong market for that. They already know about this far more than adults. It seems constantly to sort of be trying to pat its head and rub its stomach at the same time. It has a future vision which is based on amazing stories and Disney Imagineering, but then you've got a shop selling nostalgia that ends up to be a haven for bad guys. It doesn't know what it's doing.
And a shop which has convenient other Marvel and Disney.
Well, they own everything. How could you fill
it's
a...
Hard not
there
to.
Is a lot of strange products. The bit with the Coke where she drinks like 3 bottles of Coke. Like, oh, have a Coke. It will make you feel better. It was a bit jarring, I felt, but I don't know.
I didn't even register that.
I would also give a props out as well though to the young girl who plays Athena, who I haven't seen before. I thought she was very good. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but I thought she was very good. I hadn't seen her in anything else.
Rafe Cassidy is the young girl who plays Athena, who's the girl who sort of spans a generation.
I thought she was very good because it wasn't an easy part, and I thought she did. I thought she did an excellent job.
Okay. All right. Well, I think we're a bit tricked in between. Sort of want to give it.
It's smoke and mirrors. It's all set up and no payoff, really.
But it did have a heart. Mm. But it does, like Toby said, I think it's trying to do. It doesn't succeed, but I think it is trying to do something. And for that, I want to like it.
In this day and age, where Avengers, which is a good film, but doesn't do any, it seems exhausted by its mere presence.
I disagree with that view of Avengers, and also disagree with that view of Tomorrowland.
I think this is less dull than Avengers, personally.
Okay.
I like the Avengers.
Okay. All right. Well, okay. Well, Tomorrowland, which we cannot make up our minds about. It opened yesterday, May the 22nd. It is showing at both Cambridge Multiplex Cinemas. It is a certificate PG. That is all the time we have for all that we have time for on the show today. As always, there'll be a podcast released in a couple of days with more of the interview with English Heretic. You can find all of that by following us on Twitter or on Facebook. Normally we'd be back in 2 weeks' time, but instead we'll be taking another short break as Cambridge 105 will be broadcasting live from the Strawberry Fair. So instead we'll be back in a month's time on Saturday the 20th of June, which will include Jurassic World, The Look of Silence, Listen Up Philip and Mr. Holmes. We will wrap up with some of the music from Raiders of the Lost Ark, John Williams' iconic score, because it is screening at the Arts Picture House in 70mm tomorrow, followed the next couple of months by Temple of Doom and Last Crusade. Please stay tuned for Bookmark from everybody here on Bums on Seats. Goodbye.